Hello, folks. Welcome to the LRIS Premium Podcast Series. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host today as I have a conversation with Isaac Kaufman about a very important decision that has come down from the Minnesota Supreme Court. First, a little bit of background about Isaac. Isaac is an attorney, graduated from Wesleyan University. His undergraduate degree was from Wesleyan, and he received his Juris Doctor degree from Northwestern. He then had a stint as an assistant corporation counsel for the city of New York and eventually wound his way to Minnesota. Isaac works for what is known as Law Enforcement Labor Services, Inc. LELS, as it is known, is a labor organization, and it is the largest law enforcement labor organization in Minnesota. They have local unions throughout the state, from departments that are the very small to those that are very large. Isaac is now the general counsel for LELS. He's the head of the LELS legal department, and Isaac has been involved in hundreds of disciplinary cases, either at the arbitration level or through the court system. Isaac's going to talk to us about a case that involves the city of Richfield, Minnesota, and it's a case where we had a terminated police officer who was reinstated through the arbitration process, but the city elected not to comply with the arbitrator's decision, instead to challenge it through the court system. And that resulted in a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court about the confines of what's known as the public policy exception to the finality of arbitration decisions. As you'll hear from my conversation with Isaac, the usual rule is that arbitration decisions are final and binding, period, end of issue. The arbitrator's decision is it. There are some modest exceptions, however. There are some exceptions if, for example, the arbitrator decides an issue that was not tendered to the arbitrator. So, in other words, the decision was not in the arbitrator's jurisdiction. If, for whatever reason, the arbitrator's decision was procured by fraud, it's not enforceable. And there's also this more amorphous exception, where the arbitrator's opinion is not enforceable if it violates public policy. What Isaac and I talk about are the confines of that public policy rule. What does it take for something to be a public policy that could potentially result in overturning an arbitrator's award? What sorts of decisions by an arbitrator will a court review? And which ones will they leave undisturbed? In the process of this conversation, Isaac does, I think, a very good job of taking apart the factual circumstances of this termination case. It's a case that is influenced largely by a very brief video, actually videos, once they were all collected. And then we'll get into a description of the public policy rule. So with no further ado, I give you Isaac Kaufman. Isaac, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Will.
Hey, Isaac, I've introduced you as being with Law Enforcement Labor Services in Minnesota. Let's start by talking about what LELS is. What does it do?
Sure. Well, we're a collective bargaining organization. We represent police, correction officers, and dispatchers throughout the state of Minnesota.
How many bargaining units does LELS represent?
Gosh, well, we're the largest such collective bargaining organization in the state. At last count, we were upwards of 320 separate bargaining units, and that's totaling more than 6,000 members.
And how many lawyers does LELS have working with it?
Right now, three. I'm the general counsel, and we also have two staff attorneys on hand.
I think that's pretty fair, 100 locals per attorney. That won't keep you busy.
We keep plenty busy. A lot of road time.
Yeah, I don't doubt that at all, and some long distances, too, mm-hmm. in Minnesota. Minnesota has a somewhat of an odd collective bargaining law where there's a bargaining statute, but there's not really a state labor board that has the ability to adjudicate unfair labor practice complaints. Do you know how that came to be, and what do you do that would be a substitute for a ULP if you can't file one?
Sure. Well, it is kind of an odd situation. Our Public Employment Labor Relations Act, or PELRA, does have a section which itemizes what kind of conduct would be considered an unfair labor practice, both from the union side and the management side. And over the last however many years, the only way to assert a claim for an unfair labor practice was through the courts. And that, as you can imagine, has presented a lot of problems and really deterred folks from asserting those kinds of claims because the courts are slow and expensive. And you also, you know, might wind up in front of a judge with little or no expertise in labor law. Now, more recently,
Isaac.
Yeah.
Isaac, let me stop you right there. I'm going to carpet your use of the word might. You are guaranteed to find yourself in front of a judge who has no labor law experience.
Well,
I could just imagine the average trial judge in Minnesota, like the average trial judge in Oregon or any other place I've been, you'd bring a labor law case into them and they'd say, what?
You're absolutely right, and I was probably being a little too generous. But the more recent development is about 3 years ago, the legislature did create an administrative board, a public employment relations board, or PERB, specifically for the purpose of hearing these types of claims, unfair labor practice claims. However, they didn't allocate enough money for the PERB to actually operate, to actually investigate and hear and process these cases. So the PERB exists on paper, but as of right now, it's still kind of like a shadow agency without a real budget or without any resources to operate. There's recently been a change in the balance of power at the state legislature, you know, political party wise, and there is some feeling that we might be able to get the necessary funding for the PERB to operate, but it hasn't happened yet.
So, at least for the present, you're still filing those ULPs if you are in court.
That's correct.
All right. Now, I've asked you to speak about a case in which you were involved that was decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court. I view it as being a very significant public policy case. But before we get into the case, first of all, congratulations. It's just really a solid win for you before the Supreme Court.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is a case that involved the city of Richland in Minnesota.
Richfield.
I'm sorry, Richfield. And a police officer by the name of Nathan Kinsey. So before we get into the incident itself, tell us a little bit about Richfield, how large it is, what are the demographics of it, and also about Officer Kinsey. What sort of work record does he bring to this case?
Sure. Well, Richfield is a first ring suburb of the Twin Cities, of kind of to the immediately to the south and west of Minneapolis. It's a mid-sized suburb. I couldn't tell you for sure how many people, but probably in the 50 to 60,000 residents, give or take, maybe a little bit more than that. Not particularly affluent in comparison with some of the other suburban areas nearby. And they have a mid-size police department. Nathan Kinsey had been with Richfield for about 9 years. Overall, pretty good work record, good evaluations. He'd gotten special assignments on the SWAT team. He'd been a canine officer, a school resource officer, There was testimony at the arbitration, which I know we're going to be getting to in a few minutes, from a number of character witnesses within the department who, you know, described him as just a good officer all around, trustworthy and responsible. He had had some issues, and this is certainly relevant to what got him fired and what we wound up litigating about. He had had some issues with the level of detail that he was including in his reports. This was, I guess it's fair to say, kind of an ongoing issue for him. He'd received some coaching about his report writing, and in 2013 he'd actually been sent for remedial training in report writing, and the quality of his reports improved noticeably after that.
So let's get up to October 3rd, 2015, and a night in the park. What happened?
Okay, so Officer Kinsey and one other officer were dispatched to a call. The report was that a group of young adults were in the park and the area surrounding the park, horsing around in their vehicles, just driving around in a, you know, reckless and potentially dangerous manner. The officers stopped the vehicles, and Officer Kinsey was in the process of writing citations for the drivers for various violations, reckless driving, driving after revocation, driving without proof of insurance, etc. And while he was doing that, he got into an altercation with one of these drivers. And wound up, after quite a bit of yelling back and forth, wound up both pushing this individual and striking him on the back of the head, although, as came out during the arbitration, the strike was with his non-dominant hand and made really minimal impact. It wasn't even hard enough to knock him off balance. After that, Officer Kinsey goes back to completing these, writing these citations. Afterwards, he checked with his sergeant to ask whether he should pull an ICR number, which is, you know, the first step in writing an incident report. And the sergeant said, no, not necessary. Just write notes on the tag. That was the kind of colloquial phrase that they use to indicate you can just write some information on your copy, the officer's copy of the citation, to refer back to in case you wind up in court and need to refresh your recollection. And that at that point, Officer Kinsey thought that that the whole thing was over and done with.
But it wasn't.
But it wasn't. So
the media gets involved, right?
Yes, it did. So this gets into really the perils of social media for everyone, really, but for law enforcement in particular. One of the other young adults who was part of this group involved in the conduct that had resulted in this call captured the altercation on video on his cell phone. Posted a portion of that video on some social media platform, I think it was Instagram, without any kind of context, without any of the events leading up to the altercation. Now, I should mention that the young man who was in this altercation with Officer Kinsey is of Somali descent or Somali extraction, and we have a sizable Somali immigrant community here in the Twin Cities. After this video was posted, the city was contacted by somebody from a local, you know, Somali advocacy group, and because Officer Kinsey hadn't written a report, this was the first that the city or the command staff at the police department had even heard about the incident, so they were taken by surprise. And there was quite a bit of media coverage, you know, including links to that video over the subsequent weeks and months.
Was there a criminal investigation into Officer Kinsey?
There was. That was the city's first course of action was to treat this as a criminal assault or an alleged criminal assault. It was first referred to the county, this being Richfield being in Hennepin County, the same county as Minneapolis. It was reviewed by the county attorney for potential criminal charges and then by the city attorney for potential misdemeanor charges, and both criminal prosecutors declined to press charges, basically determined that there were not sufficient grounds to move forward with a criminal case against Officer Kinsey.
So that's the end of the case. Everybody goes home happy, right?
Well, we wish. It then gets into an internal investigation and an internal administrative proceeding.
And the result is what?
The result is termination. After a fairly extensive investigation, the city decides to fire Officer Kinsey based on findings that the force that he had used on the individual was excessive, that his conduct was motivated by racial bias, and of course that he had not properly reported the incident. Those would be the main allegations that they based the termination on.
I'm really curious about the second of those, racial bias. What evidence did the city cite for the conclusion that Officer Kinsey was motivated by racial bias?
Well, there were some comments that that Officer Kinsey made, and again, this is all captured on video. There were some comments made, certainly not explicit racial slurs, but comments that the city construed as indicating that that he was biased against these individuals and was making assumptions based on their race and ethnicity.
What's the worst of them?
The worst that he said? I would need to consult the specific findings by the arbitrator, but I believe there was something along the lines of you people never told the truth in your life, or something, characterizing that because it's undisputed that both the individual he got in the tussle with and the other young adults who were in this group were not being truthful and were not being forthcoming about, why they were in the park, whether or not they had their licenses available, who had been driving, and so forth. And there was a comment that the city chose to construe as, that's indicative of their race and ethnicity. But the arbitrator rejected that in the context of everything else that was happening.
So you end up in arbitration. And,
right.
One thing that struck me immediately on reading the arbitrator's opinion, which, by the way, thank you, you sent to me some time ago. One thing that struck me was you had a 5-day arbitration over what looks like a fairly confined incident in terms of the number of witnesses and everything. What took so long?
Well, my disclaimer in answer to that is that I actually wasn't the union attorney representing Officer Kinsey at arbitration. It was our staff attorney, Kim Sobiak, and I should take a moment to give her fair share of the credit for the outcome in this case, because, of course, if she hadn't done the excellent job that she did and we hadn't gotten an arbitration award in our favor, then everything that happened after that would have been moot, and it would have just been a run-of-the-mill type grievance arbitration.
Isaac, I got to stop you there. I have a rule in my firm that we don't ever offer praise to associates in the firm. It sets kind of a bad precedent, and I don't want you to go too far here, okay?
Well, I'm not from Minnesota originally, but it's possible that some of the Minnesota nice has leached into me over the years. But no, in all seriousness, Kim really did do an excellent job. Yeah, as far as the length of the hearing, what Kim tells me is that, first of all, they had set aside 3 days for the hearing, and the city's attorney wound up taking 2.5 of those days just to present their main case. It sounds like it was quite redundant in terms of, you know, reviewing the transcripts from the statements taken during the investigation, particularly in terms of reviewing the videos. So we had that cell phone video that I already mentioned. It was also squad video from at least one, possibly more than one squad car with, you know, different perspectives on what had happened. And yeah, frankly, it sounds like because of the nature of the allegations, it just became necessary to go over those videos, you know, just really getting into the minutiae of everything that had happened between these individuals on an almost, you know, frame by frame kind of basis. So it was an exhaustive effort by everyone involved, and it wound up stretching out over 5 whole days.
And so you did precisely, you meaning everybody involved, did precisely what the Supreme Court and Graham versus Connor told us not to do, right? to take those videos and look at them on a frame-by-frame basis. But that's the way these things turn out. I mean, that's what happens when you have a video. You end up, we've now created this culture in labor relations, particularly with policing, where we need this whole phalanx of video experts in order to try some cases that used to be pretty simple to try in the past. So take us through what the arbitrator decides. After this hearing, what did he do?
Sure. The arbitrator, her name is Charlotte Nye, and her award...
I'm sorry, it's a her.
Oh, that's quite right.
My apologies.
So comes back with an arbitration award sustaining the grievance in part, or in significant part, the finding being that there was no just cause to terminate Officer Kinsey, that the force that he had used on this individual was not excessive given the totality of the circumstances, no evidence of racial bias, and as for the failure to complete a report of the incident, the arbitrator agreed that that was a problem, particularly, you know, in this day and age with the kind of scrutiny that police officers and police departments are under. But, and this was extremely important to everything that happened through the appeal, but she ascribed that to a lapse in judgment rather than, you know, it wasn't any kind of deliberate cover-up on the officer's part. She called it a lapse in judgment that he hadn't completed a report. So as far as the remedy, she ordered that Officer Kinsey be reinstated and that the penalty be reduced from termination to a 3-day unpaid suspension. So needless to say, we considered that a win.
Well, yes, anytime you get a termination overturned, it's a win for a union. I want to put kind of an emphasis on what you just said. There were 3 charges against Kinsey that he used excessive force, that his actions were motivated by bias, and then lastly, that he failed to write a report. The arbitrator decides in this case that the city failed to prove charges 1 and 2.
Correct.
And the only charge that is sustained is the failure to write a report. And just for our listeners, I want everybody to sort of tuck away in the back of their heads that decisions as to whether or not Kinsey used excessive force or whether he was motivated by racial bias, those are in essence factual conclusions by an arbitrator. And so that's what the arbitrator is deciding the facts were. And that's going to become very important as we go through this process. So for now, just tuck that away. Think about it as we end up talking about the path this case took. So the city and you get this arbitration decision. Some discipline is upheld, a 3-day suspension. Everybody says, this is all cool, we'll go away, right?
Well, No. And here's where things took a very unusual, I dare say even unprecedented turn. So just to back up for a moment, you know, we handle a lot of disciplinary cases up through and including grievance arbitration. Frankly, we win some and we lose some. And in circumstances where a terminated officer is reinstated through arbitration, that in every other case that I had handled up to that point, is the end of the story. The department obviously doesn't like it, but understands that they're obligated to put the officer back to work. Richfield did not reinstate Officer Kinsey right out of the gate. What they did instead was to file a motion to vacate the arbitration award in district court under the so-called public policy exception. And you want me to elaborate on what that means?
Yeah, just in a second, but just so... So we can get ourselves up to the ultimate decider here. The city challenges it on public policy grounds, ends up winning on public policy grounds. The Court of Appeals overturns the arbitrator's decision. You then appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has to decide, did this arbitrator's opinion violate the public policy rule? So with that as a backdrop, what's the public policy rule?
Sure. Well, it's non-statutory. There are, under state law in Minnesota, and I imagine in other states as well, there are, statutory bases for challenging an arbitration award, evidence of bias or fraud on the part of the arbitrator, things of that nature, or if the arbitrator is acting clearly outside the bounds of his or her authority. The statute in Minnesota doesn't say anything about this public policy exception, but it was recognized back in 1993, I believe, as at least potentially a basis for challenging and vacating an arbitration award. And what it essentially relies on is a demonstration that enforcing the award, in this case reinstating the employee, would itself violate a well-defined and dominant public policy. That's the crux of it.
We get a lot of the interpretation of the public policy rule from federal labor law, don't we?
We do. This all goes back to the W.R. Grace case and the Misko case. Those are two United States Supreme Court decisions from 1983 and 1987, respectively. The language that I just quoted about the well-defined and dominant public policy, that's directly from W.R. Grace. The exception must involve a policy that is well-defined and dominant and is to be ascertained by reference to the laws and legal precedents and not from the general considerations of supposed public interest. That's language, again, from the U.S. Supreme Court in W.R. Grace that you'll see quoted over and over again in these public policy exception cases, both at the federal and the state level. And then, as I mentioned, in 1987, you had this Misko decision. The holding there, interestingly, was that an arbitration award that reinstated a heavy equipment operator who had been found in possession of marijuana on the company premises, that there was no basis to overturn or to vacate that arbitration award. In other words, that there is no public policy violated by enforcing an award, even under those kinds of circumstances. So that's the federal backdrop.
See, and when courts are looking at this public policy notion in trying to determine what public policy is, they want to see something very specific, don't they?
Yeah. Again, the language from W.R. Grace talks about laws and legal precedents rather than general considerations of supposed public interest. So the burden is going to be on the party filing the motion to vacate, typically the employer, to identify what those laws and legal precedents are from which the well-defined and dominant public policy could be, you know, could be understood.
All right. So now let's get to the Minnesota Supreme Court and this case. And let's talk first about the first two charges, where we don't really have the public policy rule implicated all that much. The first two charges, of course, being excessive force and also whether or not Kinsey was motivated by racial discrimination. What does the court say to the city about those two charges and the arbitrator's opinion?
Well, you know, this is part of why we were so surprised that the city sought to apply the public policy exception in the first place, because coming out of this arbitration award, we had clear and explicit findings by the arbitrator, who, after all, is, you know, the finder of fact, clear and explicit findings that there had been no excessive force and that the conduct was not motivated by racial bias. So throughout the court proceeding, first in district court, up through the Court of Appeals, and then ultimately at the state Supreme Court, those were findings that that the court wasn't going to touch. And the city understood that those findings were essentially off base. So they had to take the findings that they had, in particular with respect to Officer Kinsey's failure to write a report on the incident and to formulate a public policy exception based largely on that violation. Because it was, you know, outside the court's authority to question it was understood by all parties. I think it's fair to say that the courts do not have the authority to question or re-examine the arbitrator's findings on those other charges.
And I think this is a very important point, and one that the U.S. Supreme Court has made many times and courts all around the country have made many times. They say, in essence, arbitration is a system of private jurisprudence. You have collectively bargained to substitute the arbitration process for the process that we would use to adjudicate any other breach of contract, which means an appeal or a challenge through the court system. And if you've agreed to use arbitration, and you say it's final and binding arbitration, largely you're stuck with that. And in particular, you are stuck with the factual findings of the arbitrator. An arbitrator can be wrong on the facts, and their opinions will be upheld by the courts because that's the nature of the deal that you struck. You've agreed binding arbitration means precisely that, binding arbitration. And when I saw how the Supreme Court dealt with these first two issues, I had very much the same reaction you did, Isaac. It's like, why would the city even raise this as a potential claim? I mean, you were all done when the arbitrator decided no excessive force and no motivation on the basis of race.
Right.
And yet it still finds its way a little bit into the Supreme Court's opinion in this case, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, the Court of Appeals still managed to turn this in some respects into a use of force case, even if it wasn't an excessive force case based on the arbitrator's findings. The reason the Court of Appeals ruled against us and why we had to petition the Supreme Court for further review is the idea was, well, maybe there was no excessive force in this particular case, but the only way that departments can properly monitor use of force to determine whether or not the force in a given case was excessive is if officers write the reports that they're supposed to write. So that's how the Court of Appeals, in a in our opinion, kind of convoluted logic, but that was how the Court of Appeals concluded that there is a well-defined and dominant public policy that would justify vacating the arbitration award.
And the Minnesota Supreme Court doesn't buy that argument at all.
Correct.
What does the court hold on the public policy concerning writing police reports?
So we just got this decision about 2 weeks ago, and they reversed the Court of Appeals unanimously. This is a state Supreme Court of seven judges, reversed the Court of Appeals unanimously, and in doing so reaffirmed the arbitration award, essentially holding that it is the arbitrator's authority not just to make the findings of fact that we've been talking about, but also to determine the appropriate level of discipline for a given violation. In this case, the issue with Officer Kinsey's reporting, and the Court of Appeals really deferred altogether to the arbitrator on those issues. And as far as the standard for this public policy exception, they very explicitly held that there is no well-defined or dominant public policy that would be violated by enforcing the arbitrator's award and reinstating this officer.
And there's an important distinction to be made here in these public policy cases. It's not whether the arbitrator's rationale in any fashion violates public policy. It's rather whether the arbitrator's decision to reduce or eliminate discipline violates the public policy. It's the remedial order on which courts focus. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So it would be a good time to mention the one case in Minnesota where the public policy exception has been applied to vacate and overturn an arbitration award. That was out of the City of Brooklyn Center from, I want to say, 2001, sometime in the early 2000s. And there you had an officer where there were findings by the arbitrator that the officer had engaged in a 10-year pattern of, stalking and harassment and other, what was described as predatory behavior towards women. The arbitrator decided to give the officer his job back anyway. And when that got up to the state court of appeals, the determination was made, well, public employer has an affirmative duty, with citation to specific statutes and rules. There's an affirmative duty to protect its employees against this kind of behavior. And that's exactly the kind of, well-defined and dominant public policy that is necessary for, in the very rare and narrow circumstances where this exception is going to apply. And, I think we were able to distinguish the Kinsey-Richfield case, pretty easily from that kind of fact pattern.
The discussion you usually see in courts on this issue when they're focusing on the arbitrator's remedy is there some state statute or something in the state regulatory scheme or something concrete and specific you can point to that would say discharge and only discharge is possible under these circumstances?
Right.
And in the absence of that sort of state statute, or as these public policy cases are usually phrased, the dominant and specific, clearly laid out public policy, the fact that an arbitrator chose a different disciplinary sanction is not going to be important. It's not going to raise a public policy issue. Now, Isaac, I'm sure you've taken a look at this public policy issue, not just in Minnesota, but also in a variety of other states. One of the areas we see the public policy argument popping up time and time again is in law enforcement, where you have an arbitrator who has found that a law enforcement officer has engaged in dishonesty, but for whatever reason has decided not to uphold a termination of the officer. Instead, it might be a lengthy suspension or reinstatement without back pay. And there might be mitigating circumstances that would be related to the officer's long, positive work record, that sort of thing. And you are starting to see employers challenge those decisions, those reinstatement decisions, on public policy grounds, citing usually one of two things, citing either a state regulatory scheme, like a peace officer standard and training regulatory scheme, or citing the Brady rule, saying right. This is now a Brady officer, so you can't reinstate him. How are those cases getting decided by the courts?
Sure. Well, first, just to mention how Brady came into play in the Richfield case, because it's an interesting illustration of what you're talking about. As I described before, Officer Kinsey did not file a report on this incident. The city alleged from the outset that this was a deliberate act of dishonesty on Officer Kinsey's part, and basically an attempt to cover up the incident and to prevent his supervisors from finding out about it. And he was designated by the city's attorney as a Brady officer or Brady impaired. But as I mentioned earlier, it was one of the arbitrator's findings that this was not a deliberate act of dishonesty, but merely a lapse in judgment on the officer's part. Nevertheless, the city tried on appeal to rely in part on this Brady issue for the proposition that that public policy, weighs against them being required to reinstate the officer. But obviously that didn't get them very far. As far as how this is being handled in other cases, or in other states rather, a couple of cases that I'm familiar with. One is the Kitsap County matter from Washington, where I believe you filed an amicus brief, if I'm not mistaken.
I did.
Kitsap County matter.
For friend of court brief.
Yes,
I confess. I did.
And
by the way, Isaac,
yes?
That's some of the greatest examples of brief writing you'll ever see.
In that particular case? I'll have to go back and look at the filing. Certainly sounds worthwhile. So the deputy
don't bother.
Well, the Kitsap County litigation, we had a deputy who had, according to the Washington State Supreme Court's opinion, had 29 acts of misconduct documented against him, including some acts of untruthfulness, which I guess is the issue that you're particularly inquiring about. The arbitrator reinstated him basically on the grounds that termination was too severe a penalty. I believe there was in particular some concerns about the mental health of the deputy and indications that the county should have offered him some counseling or treatment services rather than just jumping ahead to firing him. In any event, this issue goes all the way up to the Washington State Supreme Court under the public policy exception issue, or based on the public policy exception issue, and the court found that there was no well-defined or dominant public policy to prevent enforcement of the arbitrator's award and to prevent reinstatement of this officer. I have a quote here from that opinion. Quote, there is no statute prohibiting persons found to be untruthful from serving as officers or placing an affirmative duty on counties to prevent police officers from ever being untruthful. I think that's some pretty remarkable language from a state Supreme Court, considering, the high standard that we hold law enforcement officers to. Taking a slightly different approach, there's a case out of Connecticut from 2014 called Town of Stratford, where an officer was fired after having a seizure, and there was a determination that he had failed to disclose that the seizure was a result of his alcohol use. And there again, he was reinstated through the arbitration process, although in that case without any back pay. The Connecticut Supreme Court took a somewhat different approach, came down with a somewhat different conclusion, legal conclusion, than the Washington court had done. Quote from Town of Stratford is, "The public expects police officers to be credible and honest in their law enforcement duties. We conclude there is public policy against employment of law enforcement personnel who have engaged in intentional dishonesty that directly pertains to their qualification and ability to perform official duties." Now, applying that standard, they still declined to vacate the arbitration award. So that the arbitration award was still upheld and the officer still got his job back. But I just thought it was interesting that these two state Supreme Courts really reached a different conclusion on the question of whether dishonesty in and of itself could be a basis for applying the public policy exception, and whether, you know, whether that could potentially be used as a silver bullet or an end around on the just cause standard for a department who's looking to get rid of an officer.
And I do think the jury's still out on that question. The majority of cases would take the or majority of states would take the approach taken by the Washington Supreme Court in the Kitsap County case.
Right.
But there are exceptions. As you mentioned, Connecticut, there's the state of Massachusetts just fundamentally can't decide what it is going to do with the public policy.
Well, that's my home state, so I have to push back on that a little bit. But yeah, it's true. The Massachusetts cases have been all over the place.
Now, Isaac, you've been incredibly generous with your time with us, and I need to wrap up. But before I do, I have to compliment the state of Minnesota for being the only state to ever elect to the Supreme Court a member of the NFL Hall of Fame.
The first, and probably that's something that may never happen again. That's Alan Page you're referring to. He's quite a hero around these parts, as you can imagine. There's a lot of streets and buildings named after him.
He served with incredible distinction, not only as he was basically the negotiator for the National Football Players Association for a while, and then became an attorney general, assistant attorney general, and then was eventually elected to the Supreme Court. And he had a long and very distinguished career on the Supreme Court, wrote a lot of great opinions, and then you forced him out with mandatory retirement.
Well, I'd certainly agree that that he served the court with distinction. Since we got a unanimous opinion in our favor on this Richfield case, I wouldn't want to call anybody into question who's currently serving on the Supreme Court. I think they're doing a hell of a job.
Yep, that's the way I always feel. Hey, Isaac, thanks so much for taking the time to not only recount for us this case and in the detail you have, but also sharing with us your view of the public policy.
My pleasure, Will. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. So, folks, that wraps up this edition of the premium podcast series for Labor Relations Information System. Our guest was Isaac Kaufman, who's the general counsel for the Law Enforcement Labor Services in Minnesota. Hope you join us for another edition of the premium podcast in the future. This is Will Aitchison signing off.